level of concentrated study I'm able to give to these verses, especially because they're very, very long and complicated purports. So at least what I'm going to do in this class, I'm kind of finishing up my stay. Those of you who know me, I go to India every year for, 5 months. And it seems just before I go to India, then the possibilities or the opportunities to exchange and share this wonderful tradition of spiritual knowledge seems to intensify, and it entails a great deal of traveling, which is not really a good mode for the depth of concentration. So what I'm going to do, at least in this class, is I'm going to go back a little bit and just sum it up again. And then come up to today's verse. So if you can do one verse today. And hopefully once I get sitting in one place and I'm allowed to study, then I can really go through these long purports, commentaries, and then maybe do 5 or 6 verses at a time. And there's a lot of interesting things coming up in these Yoga Sutras, including the yams and niyams, which are the moral restraints, how you deal with others, and the moral observances, and how you deal with yourself, to purify the mind and increase your ability to focus or concentrate, which is how the process of yoga works. And interesting, the benefits that come from actually adhering to these moral observances or excelling at them. If you excel at celibacy, which is one of the niyams, one of the mandatory, these are actually for you, this whole yoga process is actually for renunciates. The celibates. So, of course, maybe within the bhakti tradition, it can be practiced within the married life if sex life is restricted to marriage, or at the highest standard, just to children. There's some sense of celibacy in that sense. Because in Bhagavad Gita it says, Dharma Valude Bhuteshu Kamo Stibar Tarsaba, that I am sex life according to religious principles. Of his understanding, acting on that platform, I'm not the body. Actually acting on that platform, therefore not acting on the platform of the body, then the words have a conviction. And a person who says the same thing as another person, when he actually has integrity, and not just integrity to the level of acting on a high platform of that truth, that the ability for that truth to penetrate your heart and convince you is irresistible. So there's a lot of interesting things coming up. So I'm hoping I can keep the audience until then. So this is practice. The first was meditative absorption. We know that real yoga is not just the exercise, but it's this concentration, which takes a high level of sattva. The mind has to be in a very, very high form of lucidity and peacefulness and detachment and will and determination, which comes when the mind is in sattva, in goodness. And so therefore, the real transformatory power of yoga, the real transformatory power of yoga really takes place at a beginning at a very elevated stage. And therefore, for this type of yoga process, it begins at sannyas. It begins at complete renunciation to really have an efficacious effect. Of course, there can be other effects, and you become more healthy and a little bit more peaceful. But we're talking about yoga, this transformation of mind and coming to the point of a level of self-awareness. I mean, it's certainly, I see people that are controlling their minds and doing various type of meditations. It's certainly helpful. It's certainly peaceful. But as a process of self-actualization, it requires a very high level of goodness, which is why Prabhupada, my teacher, you know, criticized yoga as like a 15-minute thing in the morning and a 15-minute thing in the evening. When the texts of yoga, like Patanjali Yoga Sutras and the Bhagavad Gita, describe such a high level of goodness to begin. So this chapter, and I'm giving a little summary again, I want to make it more clear. This chapter is the practice. How do you get there? So it's almost like a contradiction, because the means to yoga, how do you get there? It's practice and detachment. And we know practice means endeavor, intense endeavor, and intense cultivated dispassion that takes a very high level of discrimination. So here, what it's really going to describe is the practice to make it accessible is for those people, even those renunciates, that are not really yet at that level. And they're not that level, that high level of lucidity and peacefulness of mind. Then the means becomes Kriya Yoga, the yoga of action, which includes Ishvara Pranidhan, where you dedicate your actions to God. Kind of like Karma Yoga. Karma Yoga means you're working, but because you're active, you have to work. You can't retire. You can't go to the forest. You can't sit and meditate all day. You work in the world, but without self-interest. But Patanjali, in a theistic bent that seems to be commonly accepted, goes further, that we should work not only without self-interest, but with dedication and love for God. So this Ishvara Pranidhan, as one of the three limbs of Kriya Yoga, is a little bit different than Ishvara Pranidhan as a object of meditation, because then the type of give yourself to God, because that's what Ishvara Pranidhan means, that give yourself to God is a meditative process. And here it's a process where you're engaging with the world. But along with that, there has to be swadhyaya. There has to be study of sacred texts to get the real, because by hearing knowledge and applying it, it becomes realized, to increase your level of discrimination. Because basically, this yoga process takes a high discriminatory power. You have to distinguish between what is the body and what is the mind. And then, one second, I just, I got it. One second. Hare Krishna, I'm going to give class now. I need a little, okay. So that studying of sacred texts and continuing this kind of mantra meditation. So this is what's recommended clearly in Bhagavad Gita. We have those Bhagavad Gita, you know, for one still attached and work is the means, and then for one is more advanced cessation at work. So Bhagavad Gita recommends this. And one has to perform austerity. There's no question of, because the deeply ingrained habits, the foundation of the desires that bring the mind externally into the world of illusion, enjoyment, they cannot be removed without some tapasya. And tapasya means some kind of conscious neglect of those impulses. If you're just following those impulses, you can't realize, you can't enter into yoga, and you can't remove them. We all see this. If your impulses come and you just follow them at whim, you cannot remove those impulses. You only increase them, and you increase the illusion that that's real life. It's such an illusion that happiness is sense gratification. And we become convinced, even intellectually may understand otherwise, but people can become convinced, right? They see the opposite sex, and they feel, if I can have that person, my life will be perfect. My life will be happy. I will be satisfied. I will be eternal. Even though you know it's not true, you're not convinced. So unless these impulses are controlled, beginning with the intake of food, the quantity, the quality, the amount, the time we take it, and our talking, and these type of things, if they're not controlled, then you can't come to the plat. You can't possibly come to the platform of yoga. And what I appreciate so much about the teachings and training of my spiritual master is that he really insisted on a simple life. And by God's grace, I got to live that. I got to live as a sadhu, where very, very simple, where I had to restrain those impulses, and how beneficial it was for me to get that kind of practice and training, especially I lived in India for so many years, how beneficial that type of training was, what it does for your consciousness, and how it enables you to actually come to a higher level of meditation. It's our choice, but it takes practice. Our minds can be all over the place, and we can be weak, and we can succumb to any type of impulses or desires, or we can control them and practice yoga. And it's our choice. So, but he does not recommend the kind of rigid tapasya where you torture the body. The more gentle kind, which means service to the guru, celibacy, these kind of things. So that was defined. And then it describes in verse 2, what is the goal of this yoga of action? It's for bringing about samadhi and weakening the kleshas. And again, these kleshas are the core. It's going to be listed as 5 as ignorance, ego, aversion, attachment, and desire to cling to life. The 4 core root desires that distort the clarity of the mind and discrimination. They cover discrimination. And when you discover, when it covers discrimination, you suffer. Because suffering is ignorance. So if these desires they cover discrimination, they torment us, because we're tormented due to a lack of clarity only. That's what we're tormented by, a lack of clear perception. So So the yoga section, you get a certain type of realization from those activities, and a certain realization and discrimination by not following your impulses, but by dedicating yourself to God, by not following your impulse to performing and living a simple life, by not following your impulses because you are controlling your mind and meditating on the holy name and reading sacred texts and giving you that discrimination. So these things lead to a certain realization, a certain clarity, where those kleshas are burnt. They cannot act. And therefore the vrittis and the thoughts in this yoga process that distort the clarity of the mind are checked. So this is yoga. It brings about that clarity of mind, and it weakens the kleshas or afflictions that torment the mind and prevent one from coming to that platform of clarity of the mind. They're often translated as obstacles, because in addition to torment the living entity, they obstruct the mind from realizing the self, which is the purpose of yoga. So klesha literally means trouble or obstacles. These difficulties in terms of the soul, of ignorance, of attachment, of aversion, they're the root of illusion and suffering. And it's a very, very vicious cycle, because if they're allowed to we have so many of these core afflictions that they don't even fructify in one life, and you have to be born again until they're all fructified. But this Kriya Yoga actually burns them. Now, they're listed, these impediments to samadhi are listed. As he does in his classical teaching, he lists them and then devotes one verse to each one that he listed. But basically, he lists these impediments to samadhi as nescience or ignorance, ego, desire, aversion, and clinging to life. And they're also often used as a synonym, klesha, for suffering, because this is the cause of all suffering, and which we'll see. It's all ignorance. Ignorance is the root. Even though there are five, ignorance is the root, and it's going to describe what ignorance is. And because of this ignorance, we suffer. We're suffering due to ignorance only. So these afflictions, which are born of ignorance, they're also called tormenting because what happens is these influences strengthen the gunas, they make one impetuous, and therefore they produce karma, and then they entangle one in the fruits of karma, which creates more karma, and it's an endless entangling cycle. So an intelligent person, he wants to end this cycle of dukkha, this cycle of suffering. He has to practice Kriya Yoga. He has to swadhyaya. He has to study sacred texts and chant mantras and meditation, which help him to develop a relationship with the divine. He has to live a simple life and practice the appropriate neglect of material impulses Otherwise, the fruit of karma. What's the fruit of karma? The fruit of karma is what we're experiencing right now. Because we haven't checked these things in the past, they haven't been burnt, therefore, some of them fructify. And how do they fructify? In the type of birth we had, in the type of life experiences we have, we've caused them. And we're going to cause them in the future if we don't practice in a way that brings us to the platform of yoga, brings our mind to the platform of goodness by performing these threefold actions that check these kleshas. But ignorance is the root. And then he describes in the fourth verse, ignorance is the breeding ground of the other kleshas, whether they are in the dormant, weak, intermittent, or fully activated state. So he describes that these kleshas, these ego, the ignorance, ego, aversion, attachment, and clinging to life, they can basically be in four stages. For example, they can be dormant. They can remain in the mind potentially. Like you can have an attachment, but it may not manifest. It may not manifest for even two or three births until there's some impetus that brings out that attachment. Of course, ignorance is never dormant because it's the cause and support of all the others. We're going to describe what ignorance is. Or they can be fully activated. That attachment can actually be exerting influence on the mind. Or it can be interrupted. You have an attachment, and then attachment goes, and then you have an aversion to the same thing you're attached to. That people are attached to sex, and then they get fried, and they become averse. They become attached. So there's some that are intermediate, some are fully activated, some are dormant, and some are weakened. And weakened is, it's very interesting, when you cultivate an opposite conception. For example, if there's clinging to life, as in, for example, I've seen this. Krishna, God, is saying to someone, now you're going to die. And they just cling to life. By artificial means, you can see so much money is spent to keep people alive in a very tormented state. And it's interesting. There was a case where they were, they were using modern medicine to keep one young girl alive in a vegetative state, and there was whether they should pull the plug or not. And there was a big uproar when the husband wanted to pull the plug. And the uproar was from very fundamentalist people. And I was trying to figure out if they believe in the soul, and they believe that that girl is going to God, why are they trying to keep her in that suffering vegetative state? Same thing in the modern healthcare. There's an issue right now that economically, I believe the kind of expense and medical knowledge to just keep people alive in tormented state will sink the economy. It cannot be maintained. Therefore, there's some talk about, medical system. If this would be cost afforded to everyone, they can't do that, and people become very, very upset. But if we're the soul, then why does the body have to be kept alive artificially in a very tormented state? If you're actually spiritually active, believe the soul, why does it have to be kept alive in a tormented state? In fact, when, the in terms of terminal cancer, the Ayurvedic, what one does in terminal cancer, person fasts to death, and therefore it is actually an Ayurvedic thing. One of my friends was dying of cancer and had a friend as an Ayurvedic doctor and sent him this. He said, do you really want to keep your life alive just for another 4 or 6 months in tormented pain, where the thing is you fast to death and then you die in a painless state? And in fact, there was a yogi. He was the editor of Hinduism Today, Subramanian, something like that. And he was a yogi, and then he found out he had cancer, and he just fasted until death and died in full consciousness. So that clinging to life, it's not clinging to life, it's clinging to the attachment to this particular body and the conception that body is the self, clinging to that out of ignorance. And how that makes us act and what that makes us do. So you want to cultivate the opposite, clinging to life, so then you cultivate the eternality of the soul. And that particular klesha will become weakened. More than weakened, it can become burnt. And if you can burn all your kleshas by deep meditation, which develops deep discrimination, then it's described as the yogi's last birth. So God's grace can do anything for us, but from a technical yogic standpoint, if we don't cultivate a high level of discrimination and a high level of practice, or a decent level of practice, and let these kleshas develop and don't, then we're going to have to take birth after birth with new life experiences. With new life experiences and then new duration of life and a new situation of birth. Oh, my God. Being born again, taking birth again. I remember when I was in the crib. I remember exactly where that crib was. I have a clear memory of myself in the crib. And then what you have to endure after that, growing up, and then when you're a teenager, in the competition to sense gratification, and I doubt that anyone here listening to the Sangha wants to live their life again. Well, if you don't, then there's a process. There's a process, and it's got to be adopted. Otherwise, you're born again. And I certainly don't want that. And then this here is describing ignorance. So there's five. Now he's going to describe each. And we'll just finish up quickly saying ignorance and ego. Ignorance, he says, is, he defines ignorance as the notion that takes the self, which is joyful, pure, and eternal, to be the non-self, which is painful, unclean, and temporary. So this is it. You take the non-self, the notion that the non-self is the self, which is the land, which the bushes and weeds of all these kleshas that torment us grow. So it's a definition, confounding nature of the soul with the body. And the body is described here in contrast to the self, and they're opposites. And the Sanskrit word for opposite or not is a. So nitya, and then it's eternal, then the body is anitya. The soul is pure. Then the body is the soul is pure, asuchi, the body is asuchi, it's impure. The body, the soul is joyful, the body is dukkha, it's painful. So the underlying fact is that conventional awareness is the exact, this awareness on body, it's the exact opposite of our true self. Our true self is nitya. And so the conventional understanding on the body is temporary. How suffering that is. That's such suffering. To think that you will be non-existent, it puts your whole life in duality, because whatever attachment you have, you inherently know is going to cause you pain. How hellish. And again, I remember when I was just a young boy, I remember where I was standing. I have a vision right now. I know where I lived on the street. I lived on 1935 Cropsey Avenue in Brooklyn. I was right before my house, thinking of my future. And when I thought of my future, I became afraid, because my intelligence went, my future is non-existence. It was so scary for me as a young boy. And that type of fear stayed on my head until I met the devotees, till I understand and got some spiritual knowledge. It sits on your head. So then, you know, he describes this unclean. The body is unclean. And there's a lot in these commentaries. Some of you have got the books, but what's in those commentaries is, or the ascetic sense, is the body is an unpleasant bag of obnoxious substances. And there are even meditations of meditating not on what the body appears to be, but meditating on what the body actually is. So, and there's Christian meditations like that, there's Buddhist meditations, any type of ascetic. Ascetic wants to have meditations that free one from this illusion. I know Prabhupada told the famous story of liquid beauty, that one man became in love with a woman, and when her husband wasn't there, the man came and said, "I want to enjoy with you." And the woman was exquisitely beautiful. The woman said, "Come back. I need some time. You can enjoy my body in in a week." And then she took purgatives and enema, whatever, and she just became haggard and emaciated. And she collected all the noxious substances from her body. When the man came back and looked at her, he said, "What happened? Where is your beauty?" And she pointed to all the liquid she saved. That's the story of liquid beauty. So that's certainly an aspect. I mean, spiritual life ultimately is very balanced. But it's certainly an aspect that touches all renunciate cultures, that the condition of the body. And Buddha had visual meditations of these realities, of how disgusting the body is, and contemplating the impurities of the body and the substances which are taken out of their context, and how taken out of the context of the body, what it's really composed of, is so obnoxious. And it's there in the yoga. And this ignorance of identification with the body is not only identification with the body, but it's the accessories or paraphernalia of the body. And therefore, one also does not become enamored with these. Gita, you know, the why, you know, sees gold, pebbles, and sand is the same, and all these kind of verses. So, and then the verse we have today is ego is to consider the nature of the seer and the nature of the instrument as being the same. And he gave the example that it's if you're wearing glasses, you see the glasses are seeing. So here is to make that distinction that the activities of the mind are actually activities of the self. Now, you know, you're thinking and things. It's to think here, it says the ego is to think the nature of the seer and the nature of the instrumental power. The seer is the soul. And remember, in this yogic process, and we had discussions with Mahamuni, where he presented from the standpoint of Vedanta that there's not agreement with this conception. But there's conception of yoga that the only awareness is of the awareness of the self and not any object of the self for some reason. And if there's an awareness of the object of the self, the logic goes that the soul, which is changeless, changes, and somehow that's a contradiction. He actually became so dissatisfied with this idea that Mahamuni wrote a whole paper on it. And I agree with him too. This sense that, you know, all thinking, happiness, pleasure, discrimination, everything is no connection with who we are at all. It's all, this is what they're saying ego is here, that when you think any of the thought processes are actually from the soul, that's illusion. It is such a disconnect from my perspective in this type of conception. There's such a disconnect between the body and the mind and the soul, then what is actually becoming liberated? If there's no experience of the soul, then what does it mean? If the spirit, if what you are now is not the self at all, and the soul itself is separate, then what's liberation? Why even cultivate liberation? How does it happen if there's no impetus from the soul, if it's all just this thing happening in matter that's external? It seems very arbitrary liberation. What, you know, what is the connection between your own? There's no connection according to this view. So I don't really understand it, but anyway, but this concept of ego is presented there, you know, as one of the kleshas, and as far as I know, ignorance is the root, and ego, which is very similar, is a more concrete and specific identification, false identification with the body and the mind. Okay, I'm going to stop from now. Are there any questions? Okay, anybody like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Govardhan.
I have a faithful era. I got your email, I guess, if I get my computer back, inviting me to your house. I'm still working out my schedule before I go. Okay, thank you. Anybody else like to say hello? People having a hard time unconnecting? Seems like people are trying. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hi,
who is that?
Bedrata Swami here.
Oh, Maharaj, Hare Krishna, thank you for coming on.
My pleasure.
This is real ecclesiastic stuff, I think. I mean, in your commentary, I can give you this section. I'm not sure, but it says, and moreover, you know, monks, a brother, just as if he had seen a body abandoned in the charnel field, dead for 1, 2, or 3 days, swollen, turning black and blue and decomposed, applies that perception to this very body of his own, reflecting this body too is even so constituted, is even of such a nature, has not gone beyond that. And moreover, monks, a brother, just as if he had seen a body abandoned in the field, reduced to a chain of bones hanging together by tendons with flesh and blood yet about it, or stripped of flesh but yet spotted with blood, or clean, anyway, it's reduced to bare bones, loosened tendons scattered here and there, so the bones of a hand lie in one direction, in another the bones of a foot, in another those of a leg, in another a thigh bone, another the pelvis, in another the, anyway, thinking this body too is even constituted, is of such a nature. So it has a lot of...
a sweet passage.
What's that?
Of sweet poetic passages.
Very sweet poetic passages. It does. I was afraid to even read them all. By the way, it was very nice at, you know, the programs I had in Washington and the kind of the contacts and people meeting. It was very nice. Mm. Yeah, with Emmy. Okay, thank you, Marge.
Thank you very much.
Are you in South? You're going to South Africa soon?
No. After India, I'll go to Africa.
Oh, when do you leave America?
9th.
The 9th. And you go where?
England, Sweden, Middle East, then India.
Oh, then India. Then after India, I guess after Kartik?
No, after Kartik is Mayapur, so after Jagannath Puri.
Oh, okay. Then you go to Africa. Okay. Okay, very well. Thank you. Anybody else like to say hello? Okay, who's ever there? Thank you. Vanchukopa to read this shaka to send the age of chapter 2 on Pablo.